Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our...
The headlines: Israeli forces storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque for the fifth day in a row after warplanes bomb several positions of Palestinian resistance groups across the besieged Gaza Strip. Russia says it has captured Ukraine's key port city of Mariupol, the biggest city seized since the war began 8 weeks ago. And an explosion at a mosque in the northern Afghan city of Mazar-e Sharif kills several worshippers and injures dozens. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. This is our top story for this half-hour. Tensions across the occupied territories are getting worse by the hour, with Israeli forces stepping up their atrocities against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. At least 20 Palestinians have been wounded by rubber bullets inside the mosque compound that is besieged by Israeli forces. The victims sustain injuries in the head and the neck. Regime troops have been intensifying their assaults on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including the worshippers who congregate at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been launching operations to counter the Israeli violence. Over the past month, nearly two dozen Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in a spate of retaliatory attacks and confrontations with Israeli forces. From Ramallah, our correspondent Mona Kandil gives us the latest updates about how Israeli violence is on the rise against Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Tensions have again flared at the Al-Aqsa Mosque when Israeli police officers, for the fifth consecutive day, raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex as Palestinian Muslim worshippers gathered for the Fajr morning prayers. It's for the fifth consecutive day Israeli forces have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in order to force the Palestinian worshippers out of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex following the prayers, in order to allow Israeli settlers enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex to raid this Muslim holy site during the one of the Jewish holidays that is known as Passover, because according to the Israeli holiday, Israeli settlers are demanded to enter Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and tour it for the Muslims and Palestinians. Of course, it's a raid, it's a storming the Muslim holy site. At the time, it's a Muslim holy site. Palestinian Muslim worshippers are not allowed to freely move and to freely pray at this mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. At the same time, Israeli police, fully armed Israeli police and soldiers, are protecting Israeli settlers in order to desecrate this Muslim holy site.
Staying with news from Palestine, the resistance movement Hamas is warning Israel against trying to change the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Head of the movement's political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, says Tel Aviv is delusional if it thinks it can change the Islamic nature of the compound by occupying it. He says the atrocities being committed in Al-Aqsa will only shorten Israel's presence and they will soon be expelled from Palestine. The Hamas leader says Palestinians will remain steadfast in their defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and that Israel's invasion of the holy site is doomed to fail. According to Haniyeh, this is just the beginning of the battle. Israeli aircraft have conducted new airstrikes on Palestinian resistance positions across the besieged Gaza Strip. Israel claims the attacks were launched in response to earlier rocket fire from Gaza. Palestinian groups say their air defenses have repelled the intruding Israeli aircraft. Our correspondent Asher Shana tells us more.
Israeli fighter jets and drones attacked training centers for Hamas's military wing, the Din Qassam brigades. The first airstrikes took place in the center of the Gaza Strip, and about an hour later, another airstrike targeted also a training center for Hamas south of Gaza City. Attacks took place as the Israeli regime claimed that Palestinian resistance groups fired a rocket from the Gaza Strip towards the Israeli regime. The Palestinian resistance groups did not sit idle while the Israeli strikes were taking place. They fired heavy caliber machine guns towards the Israeli fighter jets, repelling them from the skies of Gaza. The Israeli regime Iron Dome missile interception system was triggered by heavy caliber bullets from Gaza, in another example of the failure of the multi-billion dollar Iron Dome system from detecting or differentiating between rockets or bullets from being fired from Gaza. In reaction to last night's Israeli airstrikes, Hamas's spokesman Hazem Qasem said that the Israeli strikes will not weaken the Palestinians, quite the opposite. It will make them more determined to fight for Al-Quds and to defend the Palestinian people.
A ceremony has been held in the Syrian capital to honor dozens of journalists and employees of media outlets who have been killed covering the war on Syria. The ceremony was attended by senior officials and the families of the victims. Muhammad Ali has a story from Damascus.
The Journalists Union in Damascus organized a ceremony to pay tribute to journalists who were killed in battlefields while reporting on the years-long war on Syria. Officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, and employees of media outlets.
Syrian journalists had double the responsibility. They faced a ferocious war waged by huge media outlets on Syria. Journalists wrote their words in blood in respect of their job, homeland, and principles. We remain loyal to the blood of our martyrs.
It was unfortunately a long list of those who were killed, but a reminder of the sacrifices made for the sake of defending Syria. Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation, including one for Press TV correspondent Maya Nasser, who I proudly received it on behalf of his family.
This ceremony means a lot. It means that the martyrs are always remembered in the media outlets they work for. They sacrifice their lives for the sake of the country. We are proud of their sacrifices.
We used to miss him a lot, even when he was alive. He worked most of the time. After leaving for work for a whole month, we saw him once, and then he was killed. It's a nice gesture to honor him by the Journalists' Union.
Maya Nasser was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He was one of many journalists who was keen on being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. In Syria, tens of journalists fearlessly risked their lives, were injured or killed just to convey the truth amid a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Honoring those journalists underlines the crucial role the media plays in any war, especially nowadays. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
57 days into the war in Ukraine, the strategic port city of Mariupol is now under the full control of Russian forces, apart from a steel factory that is under siege.
As for today, all of Mariupol is under the control of the Russian army, the People's Militia of the Donetsk People's Republic, and the Azovstal plant territory with the remnants of nationalists and foreign mercenaries is securely blockaded.
President Vladimir Putin has also hailed, in his own words, the successful liberation of Mariupol. He's, however, ordered the Russian military to cancel any plans to storm the besieged plant. Putin has instructed his defense minister that saving the lives of Russian soldiers and officers should be the top priority. Azovstal, the last Ukrainian stronghold in Mariupol, is a massive industrial factory where hundreds of troops and civilians have been holed up for the past few days. Elsewhere in Ukraine, the mayor of Kharkiv says Russian forces are intensely bombing the city. And we're following breaking news out of Mazar-e-Sharif in Afghanistan, where a huge explosion has left behind many casualties. The blast targeted a congregation of worshippers at a mosque. According to hospital sources, at least five people are dead and several dozen wounded. Many of the wounded are in critical condition. Initial reports suggest that currently all rooms at the local hospital are filled to capacity. No group has yet claimed responsibility. We'll keep an eye on that story and bring you the updates as more information becomes available. While China has slammed the West's sanctions policy, President Xi Jinping says unilateral embargoes and pressure tactics like cutting off the supply chain will not work. We've discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's have a look. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. China's President Xi Jinping has once again taken the Western world to task for imposing sanctions on other countries in a unilateral manner.
In today's world, any unilateralism and extremist egoism are fundamentally unworkable, and any decoupling, cutting off supplies, and extreme pressure are fundamentally unworkable.
Xi called unilateral sanctions abusive and slammed double standards. The Chinese president did not directly mention the West's punitive measures against Russia, but he has repeatedly criticized anti-Moscow sanctions, including those imposed after the start of the war in Ukraine. Elsewhere in his speech, the Chinese president called for building sustainable security architectures and finding peaceful resolutions to global crises through dialogue and negotiations. He also said efforts are needed to stabilize the global supply chain, adding, however, that China's economy is resilient and not prone to change in the long term. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have economic and political analyst Einar Tangen joining us from Beijing and from Islamabad. Non-resident fellow of the Center for China and Globalization, Zamir Ahmad Awan, is with us here on News Review. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Tangen in Beijing. Let's go over the comments made by the Chinese president in his reference to sanctions. Does he mean sanctions in general, or was he trying to pinpoint the efficacy of the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia recently?
Well, he's talking about both. China suffers under sanctions, so has Europe, so it has South Korea, Japan, under Donald Trump. Sanctions were handed out like Halloween candy. So at this juncture, Xi is making the point that these kind of regressive economic policies, this retreating behind a wall, is not going to have the same effects as building trade bridges.
All right. Mr. Ahmad Awan, there's been a lot of talk about trying to eradicate the Cold War mentality. What are those components that are making the situation right now resemble a Cold War era and a Cold War East-West standoff?
In fact, during the Cold War era, the sanction was used to coerce enemies as a tool of excursion. In fact, sanction was politically motivated, and still this mentality existed. And now in the current world, recently the USA is imposing sanctions on different countries, and especially the unilateral sanctions are not acceptable, are irrational and illogical and also illegitimate. In fact, sanction was never productive. Sanction has never produced the desired results. In fact, sanctions are harmful and counterproductive. I believe that China has raised the voice of unilateral sanctions, and the rest of the world should stand with the China and support the Chinese sense that the sanction should not be used as a political tool to coerce the enemies. Sanctions should be imposed through the United Nations Security Council or with the consensus globally. Unilateral sanctions are really, really is not acceptable by any civilized manners.
Zamir Ahmad Awan, non-resident fellow of the Center for China and Globalization from Islamabad, and economic and political analyst Einar Tangen joining us from Beijing. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. In other news, the violent arrest of a young black boy for apparently stealing a pack of chips has once again sparked outrage across the U.S., bringing to the fore the issue of police brutality. The incident happened in Syracuse, New York. The viral clip has been watched millions of times on social media, with many users accusing the white officer of racism, the man filming the incident accuses the police of treating the boy like a cold-blooded criminal. Local media reported that the boy, who was later released without charge, was just 8 years old. The New York State governor described the video as, quote, heart-wrenching. The New York police said it would investigate the incident, adding it's also reviewing body camera footage of the incident. In February, a video of police in New Jersey violently tackling a black teenager during a mall fight with a young white man sparked outrage. It prompted the state's governor to condemn what appeared to be racial disparate treatment. Community organizer Life Malcolm believes the U.S. police treat African Americans with such brutality because the system wants to keep a tight rein on black people and to colonize them. Let's take a listen.
As we know, in the country where I live, the United States, police brutality has been just the order of the day. Chairman Amala Yesitela, the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party and the leader of the International African Revolution, teaches us that the reason why we see this type of brutality all the time is because there is no other way that the colonizer can maintain its control over colonized people, colonized Africans in this case, wherever we're colonized. They have to do the most brutal, nasty, harsh types of things to us in order to keep us in check. I mean, as you know, this is April still, and Martin Luther King Jr., who now white people and others celebrate, you know, the United States government shot King in the mouth on the balcony on April 4th, 1968, killed him. They didn't have to kill him that way. You know, they could have made him, you know, look like he slipped down the stairs or died in his sleep, but they have, the colonizers have to perpetrate the most brutal types of violence against colonized people in order to keep us in check. And so this eight-year-old African boy actually is just another manifestation of that type of brutality that we see from the police and from the United States government in this country all the time.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Naseeb Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Masood Shajareh, who is the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
We were young men in our early 20s. We missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know? And now Mohammed's in Somalia. He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do, nothing left for it but to join.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you.
And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot, very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean, they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. Really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it's not really a kind of comprehensive look at this situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and in their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
Basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk. And of course, his family doesn't approve of that. So he doesn't really have his family around him. And he's on his own. And he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle. And kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm. So and he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved. But some of the men went to Somalia,
and we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's
and
where we'll the that's that. Where the film
yes.
veers. It follows one of his friends. Who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the father trying to find his son.
Pretty much, essentially, that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masood, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way because, you know, as the film was about the franchised sort of youth getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It's sort of what it sort of tackled is that here Islam, you know, it's give the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And, you know, the shots, for example, sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. While in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost. You
so
know.
You're saying there's multiple messages in this film?
It is, but yes. I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken off there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the Shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, so remember is talking about his friend who's just gone and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, who probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups, is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might be surprised to see that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is what where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually talked by British government and other governments, that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which has been disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them. And out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was... It was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, for example, many of other youth in our society, they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys gone. And that is something...
Or they get into a right-wing group that commits atrocities at home.
Atrocities at home. I mean, this is, you know, is a really a challenge for our society to, first of all, to understand this phenomenon, and then to address it, if possible. And this is sort of, did not actually reach that, look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who gets misguided and out of boredom and of nothing to do, of the fact that, you know, I mean, he was saying, they were saying that that was a group of them coming together, it was a family for them. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of Al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing. And I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam. And the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of, you know, bombers are not actually Islamic. That's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Look at the vulnerable young teenagers who have problems with their families, who have problems with the government, who have issues with police, who are an easy target for Al-Shabaab, because the person's mind is already crafted and believing, you know, in his own mind, he doesn't trust the police, because the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family, because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He comes forward, like me. Joins Al-Shabaab, ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for Al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where a Somali, young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people. And maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people. But that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically and
Yeah, no, of course. I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. Would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think, I mean, our society is much more complicated than one issue results in one thing. You know, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect. And the other aspect is that these are the youth who, some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about injustices around the world. And they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in the right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this. And the reality is that they're forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk. The elephant in the room is being ignored. And the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, activists in the real sense for the right things, for the right reason, and with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something, they want to be part of a solution, and I think we're failing them in that way. Mm-hmm. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, through our policies overseas and things, we're actually giving message that end justifies the means. You know, and that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but and at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
Yeah, the film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and mm-hmm. what they should do. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. You know, they're 16-year-olds who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to do, and it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it is a short film and it is very concentrated on this very specific
story. And that's a merit to the film, because it raises many serious questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, and that's quite important.
So. And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive to doing this thing. I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was ready at one time in my life.
I used to think that killing is okay, that, wrapping yourself up with suicide bomb, exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, and I saw that it was wrong, endless, non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Al-Shabaab. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, being tricked into this endless killing non-stop. I want to change.
So it's Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears of being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be... I don't know what he's done. Has he
done
anything
illegal? But in
the film,
does it show that path at all?
Yeah, and the film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting and it's more hopeful because it does have it's not finished yet because he is in hiding, but it's a fascinating story to me, and I think, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story
and maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Masood, following from that clip, How is it that young people, and you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining in extremist groups?
Well, it really is difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know, and this film touches on that, that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for Dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam. But unfortunately, our way of combating it is all geared towards we got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately, one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives. One for the youth to go and be a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you didn't look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing is the problem. And the other thing is actually we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this is that backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, is backfiring now, is backfiring in Syria. And out of that is actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which it's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslim, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which is social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi partners.
Well, that's definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages, Rich?
I think so. Yeah, I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of their society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about. And I kind of wish it had, but then that's another film. So. Mm-hmm.
And final thoughts for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long and it raises many questions, but as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the messages it was given. So, you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
sure,
I guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come out fairly strongly about
immoral
the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camilla Shambiati. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Something that I have mentioned a few times is when it does come to such a wonderful book like Mafatih Al-Hayat, being inspired by such great ulama like Ayatollah Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli, who is one of the outstanding students of Allama Tabatabai Ridwanullahi Ta'ala Alayh, you really feel how they lived and walked and talked with Islam and with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And in this, you know, very fast-paced world, we really do need to spend time and invest effort in learning from them, in reading their books, in listening to their lectures, in making sure that we adopt that kind of lifestyle. And in this day and age, you know, with so demanding and everything so fast, we might tend to overlook how important it is for us to pause and remember that these kind of books and these kind of ulama and this kind of information that we really need to turn to, especially when it's all related to what our ma'sumin alayhim as-salam have said. So in the likes of Mafatih al-Hayat, it's all based on riwayats that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli has selected in different chapters on different topics that Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam have said. And so we're not only benefiting from the alim himself, we're also, which is even more important, remembering what Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam have offered for us. Who have they said it for? You know, they've given it to us as a legacy, as our heritage. And therefore, you know, it's important for us to, you know, carry on with this legacy and heritage. Alhamdulillah, you know, we've been going at a good pace when it comes to sharing information about this book. And I do wish that my dear brothers and sisters are benefiting. I certainly am benefiting. My family members who listen to me are benefiting. And I think we have an obligation, a shar'i obligation, a moral obligation, to share this kind of information with those who are around us. And remember that this isn't me. We're just, you know, mediums. It's not me that's telling my brother and sister to do this or not to do that. But it's Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, it's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so that will kind of like give us that empowerment that we need. And, you know, when we do turn to Ahlul Bayt, we do feel empowered. We do feel that sense of dignity and honor. And it does give us a meaningful life. It gives meaning for our hayat. And these are mafatih al-hayat, as it says. When we were talking about making sure that we don't pollute our houses with questionable income, with haram money of any sort. And we always remember that it's not only going to damage our souls, but it's also going to ruin society. Just imagine, and unfortunately we don't need to imagine, we can see it in some countries, unfortunately, corrupt countries where corruption is at its highest. You can't get anywhere or do anything without having to bribe someone or without having to have connection on any level, you know. And sometimes we only see the small kind of contributors to this evil on a small scale, but in many cases, it's the big sharks that we tend to overlook, you know, and remembering that in no way should we as genuine believers, as Muslims, as people of a society, it doesn't matter what religion one may be, to never allow any kind of facade or corruption, not to partake in financial corruption, and not to endorse or stay silent towards financial corruption because of the dangers that it has.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand, and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Now, of course, Islam has its own understanding of what impure and illegitimate money is. And so when, for example, the hadith says, وَثَمَنُ الْكَلْبِ مِنَ السُّحْتِ, for example, in the hadith, وَمِنَ السُّحْتِ, some things, and ثَمَنُ الْكَلْبِ, the money of a dog, is suht, which means it's worthless. You don't own that money. You are not eligible for that money. That money should not be spent by yourself or on yourself or on your own other family members. And that's because there are certain cases in our jurisprudence where earning an income via those means is haram. You can't in any way be involved in any kind of transaction of things that are haram to do. When it comes to something like alcohol, when it comes to something like haram food, when it comes to something like haram items, you have a shop and you want to, for example, sell gambling instruments. It's haram. So the money earned from that is also haram. This example of the dog, we know that if a dog is not used as a shepherd dog or as a guard dog or as a guide dog, then it's haram to just have a dog as a pet. So the money of buying it and the money of selling it is also going to be minas suht. It's also going to be haram. And any other kind of example, you know, you have a certain job in a certain industry and you know that you should be observant of the relations that you have. All of a sudden, you know, you are doing something that you know is haram and you're earning an income by that. Of course, that's also going to be haram. The money is also going to be haram as well, which means it's going to be illegitimate money. It's going to be an impure income. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind.
a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.